Hey friends, I am so excited to share this episode with you. I connect with my very good friend, Dr. Rudy McCormack, who's a professor of political science here in the greater Houston area, and we discuss the 2015 dark comedy, The Lobster, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. If you've never seen one of his movies, they're very bizarre, but really, really great and thoughtful, and there's so much to them. This movie has so many different layers and different symbolic aspects that we get into in the conversation. We explore everything from the norms of society to some of the super egoic ways that we're governed in terms of our behavior. We get into the possibility of love and how that might be a type of answer to the contradiction of the human experience, and we explore so much more. I really hope that you enjoy this episode. Of course, it's going to have spoilers, so watch out for that. If you haven't seen the movie, please go ahead and watch it. It's on Max right now, streaming. And yeah, I think you're really going to get into it. Thank you so much for listening. Share this episode with anybody who might benefit from it. Take some time to leave me a positive rating and review. And as always, continue the conversation. Dude, Rudy, it is fucking awesome to be here with you. I know that we're going to be talking about this really absurd but incredible movie, The Lobster, from 2015, directed by, I hope I'm saying his name right, Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yes, and I think it's 2016 when the movie came out.
I just looked it up minute ago. Yeah, it's 2015.
Okay, because I saw it on HBO Max and it said 2016.
Oh, shit. Max, okay, so wrong. Somebody's wrong. Okay, yeah, I'm open to being corrected. Yeah. So my first question to you is, have you ever seen anything else from this director?
I'm not sure I have. Is it?
Have you seen The Killing of the Sacred Deer? And I'm asking that for a specific purpose. Okay.
I have not.
Okay.
Yeah.
The reason I'm asking that is because I didn't even know he directed both until I started thinking, wait, why are these characters so monotone and seemingly emotionless in the way they engage in dialogue? Because both movies are exactly the same way.
Really?
And oddly enough, they both have Colin Farrell.
That's awesome.
What did you think about that aspect of the movie? I mean, just to jump
right
into it.
Honestly, I thought it was just the British culture. That's literally what I thought. I was like, okay, yeah, it's just British people being British.
That's hilarious. That's fucking hilarious. Yeah. I think it's a part of it, but no, if you watch The Killing of the Sacred Deer, it's even more like monotone and without emotion, just like emotionally flat. Mm. And to me, I don't know, it serves a kind of purpose, but I'm still not sure why he does it.
Right.
But it's a bit like arresting.
It is. And honestly, the monotone demeanor that comes out in a lot of the characters for the movie, it's intentional. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
There is almost like a mechanization of love within the movie, right? It's almost like there's a procedure on how to go about these things, and it's very black and white.
That's such a good point.
Right? It's very mechanistic. There's a lot of there's stages. It's all kind of figured out for you. You just have to follow the steps. You're building furniture piece, but it's the furniture piece of love.
It's right? the IKEA
furniture
manual
piece
for love.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, okay. No, that's such a good point. And I think that'll kind of come up, you know, a little bit later in our conversation, we can kind of go deeper into that. I thought maybe we could just kind of set up the movie, maybe just a brief like synopsis.
Yeah.
Should I go ahead and just do that?
Yeah.
Okay. And please just like add whatever you want.
I mean,
basically it's a type of maybe dystopian.
It's definitely dystopian.
It's definitely dystopian. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of genre, I would say it's kind of a dark comedy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It definitely has like a comedic aspect to it. It's absurdist for sure.
Yes. It's supposed to, you said it's a comedy, right? But it has its all kinds of moments, right? Where it looks like it doesn't make sense.
Right.
Oh, or it appears like it doesn't make sense.
Dude, totally. So the basic idea is we're in this world where in the society you have to be coupled with someone. anyone who's single, if that's your loved one dies or you go through a divorce or something happens, you get sent to this hotel slash spa where you get, I think, 45 days to basically find your love partner. And if you don't, then you get turned into an animal.
Correct.
Which is fucking insane.
An animal of your choosing.
An animal of your choosing, which I want to get to in a moment. Mm-hmm. And every night, I think it is, the people in the hotel have to go out and they hunt what are called the loners. These are people that have escaped the hotel. And if you kill one of the loners, or you shoot them with like one of the dart guns, the tranquilizer guns, you get one day added to your like 45-day sentence. So there's a lot more that we could talk about in terms of the movie. That's kind of setting up the world.
Right.
And maybe as we progress in our conversation, we'll describe kind of the second part of the movie when the actor David or Colin Farrell goes out, joins the loners, and then ultimately falls in love, I think.
Right.
At least that's my interpretation. Mm-hmm. And we'll kind of get into that. But before, what I'm wanting to do is maybe play some clips that'll give us some things to kind of discuss. But as I've kind of done that little synopsis, is there anything you want to add or anything you want to say before we get kind of into some of the clips?
Yeah, for sure. So one of the stark impressions that I noticed about the movie from the moment it starts is that for your audience and anyone wanting to watch this movie, you get thrown right in not knowing what the hell is going on.
Totally.
And there's no explanation for why things are happening. You kind of slowly figure it out with the main character as it's happening. Of course, the main character already knows what's going on because it almost sounds like this is an established law or some established cultural norm. I would say it's probably both a law and a norm, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's good.
And I think as the audience, you kind of get thrown for a loop because you're not really expecting to be thrown so quickly, because sometimes, you know, movies, dystopic movies tend to explain things to you, how things certainly happened over time or some kind of like historical fact.
No, right? There's none of that.
There's none of that. You just get thrown in and you got to like, you know, pick up the pieces and trying to figure it out as it's kind of happening. Right.
Yeah, so
it
is totally.
It's got a bit of a learning curve for the audience. It makes the audience think constantly, which I really enjoy. Not many people do, but we really enjoy, right? And hopefully this audience enjoys
that
too.
And for whoever's listening, I've actually watched it 3 times. Mm. And I think each time I got a little bit deeper into it. And just, I mean, this happens probably when anyone watches movies multiple times. You just see things that you didn't sort of see the first time. And there's just a lot of that.
It's the same thing with reading.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So read things multiple times. Watch movies multiple times if you can.
Yes, correct.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and start by playing a clip which captures one of the first scenes when the character David or Colin Farrell, who's like the protagonist in the movie, when he's first being interviewed at the hotel, like in the first kind of process.
Right.
And I guess before we do that, I'll just say, you know, you find out that his wife is leaving him and you don't know why, but his only question is, does he have contact lenses or glasses, right? Because we live in a world where love gets reduced to having a type of surface similarity with someone.
Yes, yes. And one of the things that I noticed is like it's all like physiological similarities.
Okay, yeah.
Right? It's always like something that's evident. You can see it and it's observable and quantifiable, right?
Like, dude, that's interesting. Are, yeah. So, okay, so speak to this. You know, I'm a married man. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess I'm lucky in some ways to have not had to go into, like, the online dating scene, which I hear is fucking atrocious.
So happy for you.
Yeah, I'm like, very grateful. I'm on my knees right now praying, thanking God for that. But I guess I'm bringing that up to ask you, because I know that's something that's been a part of your experience. Is that a part of the online dating scene? Is kind of focusing on just the physical or the surface? Like is the movie maybe commenting on that, do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think it is. And it does a great job of doing that too. It comically. Right. It comically captures it, which I think is great. Because you do want to laugh at these things.
Dude, totally.
You don't want to take them too seriously. But yes, like it's, you know, these dating apps give you all these preferences that you can, you know, sort people by. Depending on what you use, like if you're using like, you know, some of the more rudimentary ones like Tinder or something,
sure.
That one's just based on looks.
Okay.
But even then, I think now there's preferences too. Things like Hinge also have a lot of preferences. I mean, you can go all the way down to like political ideology if you really wanted to.
Wow.
And all kinds of different like lifestyles and things like that. Yeah, it's, you can curate your own dating experience. Is that an actual, does that actually equate to good results? You know, results may vary.
Yeah, right? Yeah,
results may vary, but yeah, for most
that
people,
should be a part of like the warning label.
Yes,
is results may vary.
Yes, but for most people, it's it doesn't matter how many preferences you have; it's still a pain in the ass. Like it sucks.
Sure, sure,
it sucks. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I'm gonna go ahead and play the clip, and then we can kind of comment on it.
Sir, do you mind taking a look into the camera here for me? That will do, thank you. Have you ever been on your own before?
No, never.
Are you allergic to any foods?
No.
Your last relationship lasted how many years?
Around 12.
Do you remember how long exactly, sir?
11 years and 1 month.
Sexual preference?
Women. However, I had one homosexual experience in the past, in college. Is there a bisexual option available?
No, sir. This option is no longer available since about last summer due to several operational problems. I'm afraid you have to decide right now if you want to be registered as a homosexual or a heterosexual.
I think I should be registered as a heterosexual.
Dude, that's crazy. Okay, so here's what's coming up for me that I want to like definitely hear your commentary on. Mm-hmm. It's funny, we were just talking about this, you know, before we hit record earlier this afternoon. I watched that scene and I think of, oh, Zuko, amazing, amazing. That's Rudy's dog that has like the most incredible bark.
Yeah, he does.
but I listen to that scene and I think, fuck, this is a society of black and white, complete binaries. You're either one or the other.
Yes, yes.
If you remember a little bit later in the show, in the movie, they ask him what his shoe size is, and he says a half size, and they're like, "We don't have half sizes.
Exactly. You can have either this one or the other.
This
one, right?
44 or 45.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, "Damn, okay, what is that telling us about this
more
world?
More space for nuance.
Ooh,
yeah. I think that's what that is. That's what the movie's showing. It's like, we need to fit you in a box. You need to be categorized, right? It needs to be neatly fitted, and you need to have no space for uncertainty." Right, because I think the nuance creates a little bit of complexity, and I think the society that they're in is trying to, you know, create squares of squares and circles of circles. Right, yeah. Like it's one or the other. You can't have anything.
Bisexuality,
different.
maybe I know they don't get into this, but like what's very, I think, prevalent now in some really healthy ways, being non-binary.
Right.
Those things aren't allowed.
They're not allowed. Yeah.
You're either one or the other.
Yeah.
Why do societies do that? Do you think?
Man, this have to do with like, I always think about this like from, you know, I'm invoking Foucault here, but it's a kind of governmentality.
Okay.
Know? There's a need for categorization, right? There's a need for quantification. Cause by doing that, you're also, you can control people. Right.
And I was thinking, is it about control?
It is. I definitely think control is definitely a huge part of it. And, I think like everything else, you don't want to create discomfort and awkwardness and uncertainty.
Yeah.
Right. Because those things do exist in liminal spaces of transition and transitions are spaces where there's a lot of layered, right? Like layered complexity, and society,
grayness,
uncertainty, right? All these things. And society's like, no, we have to, right? It's an administrative society. We have to make sure that everything is capturable, that we can observe it, right? There's evidence of it. Man, I went to the DMV today. I had to show four or five different papers to show that I am the person that is actually trying to get the driver's license, right? I had to show my birth certificate, my citizenship.
Holy crap.
My citizenship, my older driver's license, and then also my social security, just to make sure they're like, oh yeah, you are the Rudy that's claiming to be this person that's in front of us.
Wow.
You see, that's it. Like they're crazy. And that's the whole point. Like it's about an administrative society of trying to make sure that there's control, right? That we can control people and we can make sure that these are the people that are claiming to be those people, but you're making it harder for people to actually be people, right?
Ugh. Dude, that's so good.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe we can jump into the second clip. So this is just a few scenes after what we just listened to, where like the hotel management is kind of explaining to the Colin Farrell character, like basically what he's supposed to be doing in his hotel experience.
Hello. I'm the hotel manager and this gentleman is my partner. We'd like to welcome you. You're one of the lucky ones. You have one of our superior rooms, which means you have a view. Did you read the leaflet?
Yes, I did.
Very good. Now, the fact that you'll turn into an animal if you fail to fall in love with someone during your stay here is not something that should upset you or get you down. Just think, as an animal, you'll have a second chance to find a companion. But even then, you must be careful. You need to choose a companion that is a similar type of animal to you. A wolf and a penguin could never live together, nor could a camel and a hippopotamus. That would be absurd. Think about it. I understand this discussion is a little unpleasant for you, but it is my duty to prepare you psychologically for all possible outcomes. Now, have you thought of what animal you'd like to be if you end up alone?
Yes, a lobster.
Why a lobster?
Because lobsters live for over 100 years. Are blue-blooded like aristocrats. And stay fertile all their lives. I also like the sea. Very much. I water ski and swim quite well since I was a teenager.
I must congratulate you. The first thing most people think of is a dog, which is why the world is full of dogs. Very few people choose an unusual animal, which is why they are endangered. A lobster is an excellent choice.
Dude, that's great. I feel a little bit bad because when my wife asked me what animal I would be when we watched the movie, I was like, I'd probably be a dog.
You'd probably be a dog, right? man.
Because, you know, we have dogs and we treat them so well. I'm like, it'd be nice to just, like, be pampered, right?
Yeah, that's true.
But what about you?
Well, it depends, right? Like, you have to be in a household that actually will create that condition for you being pampered.
That's a good point,
right?
Man.
Yeah, there's a lot of abandoned dogs out there.
I'm hearing Sarah McLachlan right now.
Yeah.
But what about for you? I mean, to kind of just, like, hover around something kind of silly. If you were in this situation, what animal would you choose? I know, man, I'm putting you on the spot.
No, but. Yeah, I was actually thinking about it, but I actually arrived at a conclusion.
Oh, shit, I can't wait to hear this. Yeah,
I think I'd be a dolphin.
Dude, that's amazing. Okay, why?
Well, dolphins are sentient. They actually use echo sonar, so they have an extrasensory experience. And they're also, they have a whole society. Like, they have community.
Yeah. They're also,
they have different cultures. Like, they're very nuanced, like, animals. And they're also very sexual.
I was
going to
say, they are sexual
they're
as
very
fuck.
Sexual.
They make it difficult for some of the researchers.
Yeah. So I think it's great, man. And plus, they're also, they have a capacity for being devious, right? And, like, playing jokes. And
maybe a great sense of humor.
Great
they
sense
like
of
fucking
humor.
With things.
Yeah, like messing with things.
Dude, I
can
see that. You'd totally be like a dolphin, man.
Yeah, dude. They're so cool. And they're just really smart. And they also have a capacity for compassion and emotions.
Yeah.
I think it's incredible.
Yeah, I love that.
So, yeah. And I also like the sea, too.
Okay.
The sea's
okay.
Really nice.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know, as a human, I like the mountains more.
Okay.
But
okay.
If I were a dolphin, I'd be like,
you don't want to be a mountain goat.
Yeah. My mountains would be the sea, man. The sea would be awesome. Yeah. I just have to like come up a couple times just to get some breath, right? And then just go back down and enjoy my Finding
that.
Nemo life, you know?
I love that.
Yeah. Sounds great.
So the Colin Farrell character says he would want to be a lobster. I mean, he gives the reasons, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're blue blooded, like an aristocrat. They, you know, fertile for other life. But is there another reason you think the movie kind of went in that direction? Like when you think about a lobster, you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the movie is just a lobster sounds absurd.
Yeah, I do think that's a part of it.
Most people would think of a lobster, right?
No.
So yeah, and like lobster society is also very hierarchical, which he doesn't really talk about.
I wondered about the hierarchy. Yeah. The other thing that I also was thinking is, I don't know if this is actually factually true, but I've heard that lobsters kind of mate for life, or they're kind of coupled for the rest of their life.
Something like that.
Yeah. And I wondered if that was a type of like symbolism for, you know, the rest of the movie and what he kind of ultimately wants.
I think you might be right, because Jordan Peterson uses lobsters as his modus operandi.
That's true, man. That is true. He is the lobster guy.
Yeah, he is the lobster guy. He thinks that humans should be like lobsters, right? And like forced monogamy. And that's where he gets all that idea from. Yeah.
I've never understood the concept of forced monogamy, but maybe you could like shed some insight on that.
Right.
Maybe we shouldn't go there.
I mean, I'll just say this, like, it's wrong.
Right? I think forced anything is wrong.
Yes, like lobsters don't even know the concept of being forced. So like they're just doing... You know what? If there's a programming in nature, that's what they were programmed to do. If they had a programming, but the fact that, you know, someone like Jordan Peterson would be like, "Yeah, humans should be more like lobsters," means the anthropomorphizing and caricaturing of human beings into
so reductionistic.
Exactly. So you know that's what we could say about that right now.
Sure. Right? So what do you make of and we have the characters right here. Mm-hmm. She's played by Olivia Colman, the hotel manager. What do you make of her statement that, you know, the fact that you might be turned into an animal shouldn't like bum you out, bring you down.
Right.
You know, she's like, just see becoming an animal as another opportunity to get coupled with someone. Like what's some of the ideology that's governing some of her statements there, do you think?
Yeah. If there's like a couple's ideology, that would be it. And it almost seems like there's a very intense dogma that exists in this couple society.
Yeah, I want to go there. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, it seems like it's an unquestioned axiom, right? Like you know, if you're not coupled, you're devalued. And you're only valued if you're coupled. That sounds like the ideological understanding of how someone's human and how someone isn't human.
Yeah.
In that society that they're in.
Like first class citizens.
Exactly.
The second class citizens are the single one. So just as a quick like biographical aside, I won't go too deep into this, but like when I was a pastor working in the church, I remember older single people, really being down about the fact that a lot of these religious communities would make them feel less than because they weren't married.
Mm.
So I knew that was a real issue there.
Yeah.
Outside of that environment, do you think that's something that is a present sort of reality in our society? I mean, I'm speaking to someone who I know who dates, but at some level is also single. Like,
yeah,
what's it like to be single in this society, you know, kind of post 30?
Yeah, I do think there's a, you know, from a, if we're using psychoanalytic languages, there's a kind of like a cultural influence.
Okay.
In the background, constantly influencing you to want to stop being single.
Okay.
So there is like a, what does Freud say? The, trying to remember the concept he uses for the cultural norms that we have to buy into.
It's slipping my tongue.
Superego.
Okay, superego.
It's a
superegoic kind of.
Yeah, the superego is conditioning us to want to not be single because we become pariahs in society. Pariahs in society if we choose to forego the cultural norms that are out there. For us to experience, right? And,
okay.
and that is conditioned to us by society itself.
So what's the message? Okay, so if we're going with like the Freudian, so I like this, the superegoic injunction to, you know, get married or couple. If you stay single, like what's the problem with staying single in that framework? Like what's the danger?
The danger is that you're not propagating society, and then you're undervaluing your capacity of what you can do in society, right? And there is like a, even in our own society, we're not going to be turned into animals, but
God, I hope not.
Yeah, right. But we're not valued in the same way. I think, especially in like spaces where there's a lot of couples and then single people are in those spaces, there is an exclusionary element, I think, that exists there. And I don't think it's done on purpose. It's just unconscious, right?
Like, okay,
That's there because of the superegoic.
Because of the superegoic
relation.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Do you remember some of the scenes? This gets into some of the comedy in the movie where, you know, I think it's like every night they have these like dramatic displays of why you should be coupled.
Yes.
You know, they have like a guy who, yes. you know, he's like eating like an imaginary dinner and he starts choking. And then they're like, this is what happens with a single person. He like chokes
to death.
Right. But if you're coupled, then you have someone there's going to save you.
The Heimlich maneuver. Because also assuming that the person who's your couple also knows how to do them.
Exactly. I actually don't know that I do, man. Like
I do, thankfully, because I worked at a hospital, so I had to do.
Dude, I'm so glad because my wife
CPR
would be
training. Yeah, I had to do CPR training, so the Heimlich maneuver is part of it. But most people don't know how to effectively do it. So even with your with a partner, it's not guaranteed either.
No.
Which I thought it was kind of, you know, comedic about the movie showing you that. Dude. But it is almost like a kind of propaganda, right? It's the couple's propaganda.
Okay, I agree 150%, but just go there a little bit. Like, talk about propaganda and how.
Well,
how
it's that's an advertisement to say, here's another reason why you should be coupled up, right?
Yeah.
As if I don't know if it's weird because like you would think that in that society like you wouldn't need a reason to be coupled up, but they're constantly showing you little moments of how much better your life is if you're in a couple.
Sure.
But they don't. They also don't show how much worse your life could be if you're in a couple.
Dude, totally.
Right?
Yes.
So they don't give you a comprehensive understanding of what it means to be in a couple, like the bickering, the arguing, the conflict.
Absolutely.
They only show you the highlights.
Dude.
Not the lowlights, but only the highlights.
And just...
So that's the propaganda, I think.
Okay. Well said. Well said. And then, you know, just another really fucking... funny part of the movie is, you know, part of their strategy is, right, if you get coupled, if you find someone, like in the movie, there's this one lady whose nose bleeds. And then one of the guys who just is desperate to be coupled starts banging his head on like the wall and different parts of the hotel in order to just have his nose bleed. And they finally get together because that's their similarity.
Right.
They start, I guess, having arguments or fighting. And so they give him a kid. Right? That's a part of the ideology of the movie is if you want to deal with your issues, just go ahead and add a kid and that's going to like help, which in reality is the exact opposite, right?
Having a kid. You know this.
I do. Creates a lot more issues. So I just thought that was hilarious.
It just goes to show you the extreme extents that they go to try to maintain a relationship. Because I think that does reflect our society in general, where couples sometimes kind of know that maybe the relationship isn't working, but because they have kids, they try to make it work. So they try to force the situation, right?
Yeah, no, totally. No, I think that's a very good point.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good point. Okay, so one of the things I wanted to kind of bring up is, and I'll just say, again, like a bit of a biographical kind of thing. Given my work in therapy, I work with a lot of like older autistic men who, for a variety of reasons, either have a very difficult time being in romantic relationships or just find that they can't ever make that really happen in any kind of sustainable way. So one of the things that we end up exploring is it possible to be in loving relationships that aren't romantic?
Mm.
And I'm going to argue, yes, that has to be a part of at least some human experience. So what do you make with that? Because I found that to be a huge problem in the first half of the movie with the whole propaganda with you have to be coupled with someone. Is that really the only way that we can be in loving relationship to others?
I don't think so. I think that's
right.
That's the caricatured and almost like the, what do you call it? The lazy way to find that, right?
Okay.
It does take more effort to look for it, but it's also like those relationships where you can find loving relationships that aren't really like that aren't romantic relationships are like unsung heroes, right? Like they're undervalued, but they have so much value to our lives, right?
Sure.
And it, it doesn't get glamorized. I think that's the problem.
No. And, you know, man, I'm forgetting exactly what they called it, but I've worked with adult autistic women who have basically bought houses with platonic female friends who are also autistic. And I forget what they called it. They called them like, if it's not sister wives, that's the Mormon kind of thing.
Yeah.
But basically they figured out a way to create a life for themselves where they were in this like loving relationship with someone that wasn't sexual or romantic, but it was more than just a friend. And I think that's actually quite beautiful.
That is a
great expression of human love.
I actually have a lot of relationships like that. Yeah.
There you go.
I mean, they're like it. I've just stumbled upon humans where we've met, right? We've created a relationship and it's turned into chosen family. You know, like you actually feel like, man, this person is the only reason that they're not family is because you didn't grow up with them and they're not your blood.
Yeah.
But if you could grow up with them, you probably would, right? Like, because you're actively choosing them.
Yeah.
And these are people that I actively make plans with. I actively travel with. I actively, you know, do things for them. Like if I need to buy them a ticket so that they can come visit me, I will buy them a ticket and come visit me. Like, I don't care. Like, they're that impactful and so fulfilling in my life that I'm willing to be like, oh yeah, this is not even something like, yeah, most people just do this with their family or their romantic partner.
Sure.
And I'm like, no, these are people who have like popped into my life, but I've actively chosen to keep them in my life, no matter where they are in the world. Like, I want to have them in my life.
Sure.
If I can have them, right?
Totally. That's really good. Okay. So going back to the movie for a second, you know, just to kind of progress it a little bit, the Colin Farrell character finally just decides that he's going to start lying to this other female there who's kind of a sadist.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
She's heartless.
Oh, God.
No emotion at all.
Yeah.
And he starts feigning that he's that way too. And at first she buys it. And so the hotel couples them together. They move into like the double room. And then, God, tragically, she ends up killing his dog, which actually turns out to be his fucking brother.
Yeah.
And she has no like remorse or emotion about it. And he clearly like breaks down and starts
in the bathroom.
So he can
run away from her. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he can be away from her so he doesn't show his emotions.
Right.
To her.
But then she like figures out you've been lying to me the whole time. And then one thing leads to another. He ultimately escapes the hotel because he knows that once you lie about, you know, your common similarity with like the other couple, you get turned into like the worst kind of animal.
I don't really know what that is. What was it?
I don't know. Yeah. See, was it a pig?
Was it a pig?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm speculating here.
I don't
here.
Either.
I don't know what the worst animal. I mean,
they never really showed it.
They don't. I mean, maybe we could speculate. What would the worst animal be? I don't know, like a cockroach or like an ant
Kafka's,
or something?
Kafka's cockroach or something.
Fuck, man.
I don't know. That's crazy.
Should a fly?
No idea.
I don't know.
No idea. No, honestly, no idea. I would like to see what the director of the movie thought the worst animal was going to be, right? Would be.
Yorgos Lanthimos, come on,
tell us.
Yeah,
right, tell us. but yeah, so
he ends up basically escaping the hotel and he goes into the forest and he joins the loners.
Right.
And to me,
well, do you remember what do you remember what he turns her into? Because I know he turns her into an animal.
I don't remember.
But I forgot what animal she turns her into. He turns her into.
He turns the sadist?
Yeah, the sadist. The sadist that he was going to partner up with. He actually goes into the transformation room and turns her into animal.
Do they show it? I can't remember.
I don't remember. I actually don't remember.
I don't think
you saw it three times, so I'm thinking you might have a better memory than
I do. And I usually do have a good memory. This is where I'm thinking she might have turned into a pig.
Interesting, yeah.
But I'm not certain about that.
I'm not, yeah, neither am I. That's okay. But he does turn her into an animal.
Yeah, he turns her into an animal.
Yep.
So he goes into the forest and then he joins this group of loners. Okay, so let's like maybe set that up a little bit. Like,
so
who are the loners?
And
how do you make sense of that?
So the loners are actually like almost like a subculture inside, You know, this couple society. Like if couple society is the norm,
okay,
then, you know, the equal and opposite reaction of that society are the loners.
Yeah.
Which is our people embracing their aloneness.
Okay. Okay.
Right? Their singleness. Their singleness.
Sure. But okay, and I don't know that this is even in any kind of tension with what you just said, but what struck me was this group of loners, which seem to be kind of rebelling against the social norms.
You can call them the radicals. I always thought them, like, these are the radicals.
Okay, so they're the radicals.
In society, right? The but ones who don't accept the status quo.
Okay, that's good. So they're the radicals. They don't accept the status quo. But then you discover they're just as black and white.
Dogmatic.
And dogmatic.
Yes.
And rule-based.
Yes.
As the fucking social norm.
So I actually noticed two similarities between the status quo society and the loners, or the radical group. Right?
Okay, hit me.
So the actual, there's obviously a lot of, the main difference is that they're a society that chooses to be single, and they have all these rules to be single,
and
right?
You cannot be coupled, right? You
cannot be coupled because they will all individually come together to punish you if you do get, if you do flirt, or if you start showing signs of affection, or
the red kiss.
Yes, the red kiss, right? Like you sew up people's mouths.
Oh.
So that they can't, you know, kiss others anymore. So it is kind of barbaric, and
it's extremely barbaric.
Bit of barbarism. It's also punitive. They believe in punitive action
and just as controlling.
As consequences. Yes. They both. So they share that they share controlling as an aspect of it. The dogma that I think they both share is a kind of repression. Like they both share repressive acts in their unique cultures, right? If the status quo society, you know, represses this single people to turn in themselves into, if they can't find a partner, they get turned in automatically into animals.
Sure.
Which is a punishment.
Yeah.
The punishment and the repression that exists with the loners is that those punitive acts of keeping people alone, of like not wanting them to create connection so that they could pair up and have actual connection with each other, right? And that to me is like, that's what I thought. I'm like, there's a similarity right there. These are two different groups in society who are traumatized, who experience a kind of trauma that is enacted in a kind of repressive society.
Yeah, that's good. So, okay, here's a question that's coming from me. What is the loner group or like the rebels? What are they pushing against in terms of being coupled? Like, why are they so threatened by romantic relationships? Is it just to push against the norm?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So there's nothing really thought through necessarily or principled.
I actually think they're pushing against the status quo.
Okay.
But I think their hatred of the status quo makes them to embrace hatred itself.
Oh, man.
Right? And I think that's why they have the very same dogmatisms that appear differently in the status quo, they bring into them with the energetic relations of the dogma itself to, if they see anything like the status quo, even if it has any semblance of it, they want to eradicate it as fast as possible.
That's so good, man. What you're getting me to think about is they're clear about what they oppose.
Mm.
I wondered, what in the hell do they affirm?
Yeah.
Are they actually affirming anything?
So they're actually affirming the negation of the negation, right? That's what they're affirming. They're trying to be a negative representation of the status quo.
Mm.
So in that sense, if we compare it to, you know, our contemporary society, it's those radical groups that might be, more left wing in nature. Like, the things that I'm influenced by are like Marxist ideas and things like that. And the Marxist groups, many of them, especially in the United States, they tend to favor, you know, authoritarian regimes because it looks different.
Yeah.
Than the empire, right? Like that's how they talk about it. And I'm like, okay, yeah, no, it is empire. Like I don't disagree with that. But why would you give credence to the same dogmas that you see in your own country in other countries by a different name?
Right, right. Yeah.
Right? And that to me is like what the movie's showing.
Yeah. No. I forget the name of the character, but the leader of the loners, I'm gonna look it up real quick.
Yeah.
She's played by Lea Seydoux. She was great. She's just as authoritarian as the hotel manager.
Yeah, she's a what is it, like a military leader, right?
She's a military leader.
You kind of see, don't get me wrong, like she has positives. Because she exposes.
Sure.
Remember when they go into the hotel and then they go into the room where the hotel leader and her husband are staying.
Yes. Yes.
And he gives the husband a gun.
Yeah.
And then to see like which one of you could survive on their own, and she made them choose. Like she created that condition for them.
Yeah.
And then she exposed the hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Of the status quo of that society. So that, in a sense, is a kind of, you know, to me, it's like a radical exposure of the hypocrisy in that society, right? But at the same time, while she can do that for what she critiques, she can't do that for herself. There's no internal reflection there.
Yeah.
She doesn't see that same hypocrisy that she's trying to expose in the couple society is a very similar hypocrisy that she does with herself.
Yes.
Right, and it's weird too, because like she goes and visits her family,
and
her family is a part of that society.
Yeah,
and she tolerates it. She tolerates it, which is mind blowing to me. And then she even tolerates it when Colin Farrell and
Rachel Weisz, who in the movie is just known as the woman who was also short sighted.
Yeah. They're making out, right, when her parents are playing, you know, the very romantic music with the guitar.
Yes.
She accepts certain parts of it, even though it appears like they're pretending to be a part of the society. She eventually catches on and she's like, oh no, this is actually happening. And then she makes a pretty drastic decisions and forces blindness on Rachel Weisz.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that they can stop having that similarity that brings them together.
Yes. Yes. That actually connects to one of the clips that I wanted to play.
Perfect.
So yeah, to go back just 1 second. So the Colin Farrell character goes into the loner group and then he meets the woman with short-sightedness or Rachel Weisz, mm-hmm. who's incredible, who she's been narrating the movie the whole time, which I thought was brilliant.
Oh man, I didn't even remember that. Oh,
yeah, yeah, good. Yeah, yeah. So she's kind of the narrator, yeah. right? And okay, I'm going to play one clip that just kind of captures in a bit of a funny way some of the ways that the Rachel Weisz character and Colin Farrell have to communicate with each other in this loner community because they can't be like out about their love.
Right.
Okay.
We've developed a code so that we can communicate with each other, even in front of the others, without them knowing what we are saying. When we turn our heads to the left, it means, I love you more than anything in the world. And when we turn our heads to the right, it means, watch out, we're in danger. We had to be very careful in the beginning not to mix up, I love you more than anything in the world, with, watch out, we're in danger. When we raise our left arm, it means, I want to dance in your arms. When we make a fist and put it behind our backs, it means, let's fuck. The code grew and grew as time went by, and within a few weeks, we could talk about almost anything without even opening our mouths.
Dude.
That was so good.
Yeah, so good. So,
it's actually better when you don't see it.
Yes,
oh my God.
Yes. Okay, so, man, I'm going to be honest. I sort of was hit by something in listening to it just right now that I didn't get even in the three times that I watched it, which is a bit embarrassing. But when she contrasts being in love with being in like the worst kind of danger.
Yes. Yes.
Is that juxtaposition trying to get at something?
100%.
Okay. What do you make of that?
I actually think the liminal space that exists in between love and danger is vulnerability. Right?
That's good.
Yeah. Because both of those things exist simultaneously at the same time.
Mm.
And to actually experience love, you need to feel like you're in danger.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Like there's a level of like, man, this whole thing could fall apart.
Sure. Right?
Like I'm very much distraught.
Sure.
because I'm exposing myself, right? Like there's no armor here.
Mm.
But it's that very exposure that creates the conditions for love.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't think that this is any different than that. I guess my little kind of spin on it would be, I think being in like authentic love puts a certain version of the ego or the self in real danger.
Yeah. Yeah.
It breaks down a certain version of yourself, which can be very painful. But I think in the scheme of things, on the whole, is a net positive.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. It is a net positive if all the conditions are met.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's the risk.
That is the risk.
Because a lot of times all the conditions are not met.
Correct.
There's no like easy way through it or any guarantees.
No guarantees. Uncertainty is there.
It's actual danger.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is dangerous. But it's, yeah, it's, that's the paradox, isn't it?
Like, it is.
The dialectic there.
That cannot be resolved. We have to hold it. What I mean by it can't be resolved is there's no easy, quick solutions. It's a type of ongoing, dynamic.
So actually, you know what?
Relationship.
I used this word last week with Fu. There's no Deus ex machina.
There's no Deus ex machina.
Right. You used that word.
Yeah.
And I thought that was perfect. Because I'm like, you're right. There is no external security. It's not gonna come there. It doesn't exist there.
Right. I know this was like going way back. This was probably like in the early kind of mid 2000s. There was like a financial planning commercial where the guy is like kind of lost in the street of like New York or Chicago, and I don't remember what company it was, but out of nowhere he just sees like this neon green arrow that's like pointing the way.
Yeah.
Right. And so he starts following it and it just takes him exactly where he needs to go. Mm. And right, the message of the commercial is something's just gonna kind of come out of nowhere and guide you exactly where you need to go.
Right.
And that is not love.
No. Honestly, the best things in life do not come about in that way.
God,
right?
I think you're right. Rudy.
Joy does not come from like just easily directed, you know, green light that shows you or green arrow that shows you exactly where you need to go.
No, because we're surprised by joy.
Yep.
We're struck by it.
Yep.
Sometimes shocked. Right?
Yep. I think to feel joy that needs to be there. Like that sense of danger and uncertainty or unexpectedness needs to be there. Because if if it's not there, then those aren't the conditions for experiencing, you know, some of the most beautiful highlights of what it means to be a human being.
Sure.
Or what it means to be alive in general. But
sure. So, man, I'm just kind of like riffing at this point, but one of the things that's coming up for me is, in light of what you just said, like the risk and the joy of love that includes the danger. Maybe that's part of what the first half of the movie is trying to show when everything is so emotionally flat and monotone, is this vision of existence, which everything is neatly put in a box, everything is prescribed for how you're going to do it, just seems so banal.
Well, you know what's crazy?
Boring.
Most people in dating, you know, they complain about the inorganicness or the unnaturalness of online dating.
Okay.
Or just dating in general in the 21st century, where everything is curated and it doesn't feel like there's a sense of spontaneity.
Okay.
And organicness. Like it doesn't feel, or people call it natural, right?
Okay.
I think organic is a little closer to what they're really referring to, but...
That is interesting, because I guess you're, even though it could all be lies, you're sort of like measuring the person before you see them and you have all this information and you're kind of coming to a judgment even before getting to experience
them.
Well,
you're not giving yourself the conditions to be surprised. Like you're trying to control.
And that only comes in uncertainty and unknowing.
You're trying to control all the circumstances so that you could feel safe. But the more you want to feel safe, you know, it's like the old adage, the more you want something, the less you have it.
Yeah.
The more you want to feel safe, the less safe you're actually going to be.
Yeah. No, that's really good.
Right. It's just like that. It's just like that. It's, yeah, people don't realize that the actions they're taking can run counter to what they're actually needing.
Yeah.
To what they actually need to be fulfilled and happy and experience joy and to have all the things we all really want, right? Like the, you know, Fromm talks about the problems of human existence.
Sure.
Which is that conflict between separation and relatedness. And it's almost like we're trying to control the process of the conflict.
Yeah.
So that doesn't last as long.
Yeah.
Right? Or the process itself, like however long it lasts, you don't give it the space to actually exist so that you can understand why it's there.
Dude.
Right? And then we just want to get rid of things really, really quickly because the discomfort is
we can't much tolerate more the
agonizing,
uncertainty.
Right? And the discomfort is much more agonizing than actually experiencing the process.
Yeah. No, that's really good.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're cool with this, I want to hit one more little clip, which is going to get into Colin Farrell and the Rachel Weisz character kind of exploring their love a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it is, you kind of already alluded to it, just to kind of recap for a second. They do fall in love. They have to keep it secret, but the leader of the loners kind of finds out mm-hmm. that they've kind of fallen in love. So they take Rachel Weisz back to the city and blind her.
Right.
And this will get into the clip for a second, but she's terrified because now she doesn't have a type of surface connection with Colin Farrell, right? Before their only like connection, the reason they thought they maybe were in love was because they were both short-sighted, but now she can't see anything.
Right.
So she's kind of having a bit of an existential crisis, but I love Colin Farrell's reaction. And then this can kind of lead us into kind of the last part of our conversation. Mm-hmm. But okay, so here's a clip.
There's no point in lying to you. You'll find out sooner or later. Our leader blinded me in the city. She must have realized that I love you and you love me and that we were going to run away to the city together. I'm sorry.
You can't see at all?
No, not at all.
And when you asked if I'd had my hair cut?
I was just saying that so you wouldn't realize that I can't see. I'm sorry.
Don't cry. Crying will make your eyes hurt more. We'll find a way.
Mm. To me, that's pretty powerful.
It is.
And I guess before we maybe add some commentary, just to kind of finish up the movie, you know, a couple scenes later, they're able to escape. And the movie kind of ends with them sitting at a diner. They're having a conversation. And Colin Farrell asks for a steak knife. And then he goes to the bathroom. And, you know, before the movie ends, it appears as though he's going to stick the knife in his eyes to possibly blind himself.
But it's a cliffhanger.
But it's a cliffhanger because then it pans back to Rachel Weisz mm-hmm. and she's sitting there waiting for him and you don't know what happens.
Right.
Hmm. So what?
So the honestly, maybe someone else you invited to the podcast would say something else, but I think based on just some of the evidence from, remember, there's actually a part in the forest still before they leave.
Okay. But before they go back to the city?
Before they go back to the city to you know, to escape the loners and then to just live by themselves. And before he tries to, you know, cut his own eyes.
Sure.
Where he actually talks to her for a little bit before. And he's kind of like, you know, iffy about like, do I want to still be in a thing with this person? Mm. And he's like, oh, I'll talk to you later. Maybe I'll see you in a couple of days or something, or I'll see you tomorrow. But he never actually saw her in the morning. He saw her like maybe 3 days later.
Okay.
But he went back to go see her, knowing that they don't have the same superficial connection anymore.
That's good.
And he still chose to leave with her.
Yeah.
That to me makes me realize, obviously this is me speculating, but I do think, I wonder if he realized that it had nothing to do with the short-sightedness. He actually just loves this person for who she is as a human being
mm.
and what she brings into his life.
Yeah.
Which is, in a sense, like he's alone. The loneliness of existence, especially people don't think about the Force, but the Force is a kind of, to me, it's a space of paradoxes, because on one sense, the Force can represent loneliness, but it also represents solitude, right? So you can be happy with yourself in the Force. You can find yourself in the Force, but you could also get lost in the Force.
Totally.
Right? But then they find each other. They find each other again. So he tries to leave. He's like, oh, I don't have a connection with this person anymore. Mm. She's not short-sighted. She's also blind now.
Mm.
And he tried to leave. And yet somehow the Force brought them back together.
Yeah.
Because she just stayed in, I mean, she stayed in the same place. Like, I don't know, no one really knows how she goes about moving places by herself when she's blind.
Right.
But he ends up finding her again. And he chooses to leave with her. He chooses to leave the Forest and now spend his life with her in another place. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Outside of the Forest.
Outside of the Forest.
Because the Forest could be a haven for him if he really wanted to.
Sure. Yeah, he could carve out a type of existence for himself with the loners.
Right.
But he wants something more.
He does.
Okay, so if I know this is going to be some speculation, so he wants something more. Let's just assume, and this is not certain, that this is actually kind of debated. If you look online, different people have different theories, but let's just say that we're going to go, at least from my perspective, go with the theory that he does, like, basically stab himself and he blinds himself. I think in part because he understands if we're going to carve out a type of existence together in this fucked up society, they're going to need to believe that we have a surface similarity. But I think about the trope, right? Love is blinding.
Yeah.
Like what? I guess
so,
what I'm.
So here's how I go. I mean, I can try to problematize it.
Yeah, please.
Just because when they were at, I don't know if it was a mall. Yeah, I think it was a mall or something. They were at a mall in the city, right? When they went to go visit the leader of the loner's family. They were buying, I guess they went to go shopping or something. And in that time, I know she wasn't blind at that moment.
No, she wasn't.
But the security guard, the police person, some kind of like repressive state apparatus, like let's just call it that.
Yeah,
like you know, someone who is a watchman, right? Some kind of guard, policeman, whatever, officer from the mall was asking him for credentials and who his partner was.
Yeah.
Right? Because you could not be seen without a partner.
You've got to have like a certificate of
being a couple. The officer never asked him what brought them together. Like that wasn't a credential for their love.
Yeah,
that's
why
I was like,
that's a good point.
I was wondering, like, does he actually have to gouge out his eyes?
Yeah, yeah,
right. Because it doesn't seem like it's a necessity to show that this is the superficial thing that you have with your partner.
Sure.
And like, here's our paperwork that says like, this is what brought us together. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't really know. Like, the movie doesn't show that much information.
No, it doesn't. I think it definitely leaves it open.
It is open to interpretation. So that's,
I guess, you know, and again, this is just one interpretation. My own interpretation was he blinds himself and maybe that goes back to the penultimate clip we listened to where they were holding the dialectic of love and danger, just unraveling the idea that to really be in love, which, you know, we're both kind of Frommians, right? Like, it's not just a feeling, but Fromm actually says love isn't even natural in a human sense. It's unnatural in that it requires sacrifice and work and effort and skill. It's not just something that appears. What if
it's a practice, right?
It's a fucking practice. It's practice, an art,
yep.
Right? What if the movie is pushing the idea that he's deciding to, in some ways, right, take out an essential part of himself as a way to truly love this other person? Mm-hmm. That I'm not saying we completely erase ourselves, but there is maybe a type of injury or wound that the ego experiences. Mm-hmm. In order to be in a type of healthy, authentic love.
So you're saying there's a type of sacrifice that exists?
Yes. I know that word is sort of loaded and it could be kind of interpreted in different ways, but I do, I'm going to stand on the interpretation that the movie is pointing in the direction that the type of love that's worthy involves a type of sacrifice or a type of injury to the ego or a pushing down, not completely, in order to be in this relation with someone else. I think it is kind of suggesting that, but again, that's my right. my opinion.
And it leads to, I can see that, it leads to a kind of compromise. The thing is, we don't really know, right?
We don't really know.
We don't know if he actually does it. Because there's also a counter argument that says there's beautiful difference that exists for love. Because I think practically speaking, it would make more sense if they were actually in love together and she were blind and he had sight. Because he could support her where she's at her weakest.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that.
Right?
And we were just kind of talking about that. I mean, I think that goes into one of my thoughts on love, which is I think in loving relationships, whether it's romantic or not, I think other people, you know, kind of fill out our gaps or they help us grow in the areas maybe where we need that growth
yeah,
or
we lack.
Or the weak, where yep. we lack. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 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 mm-hmm. absolutely.
Yeah, so that there is difference in love.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
Right? And I feel like that's something that's not... Is it mostly talked about or isn't necessarily like popularized?
Sure.
People
sure.
always look for similarities. And I think, you can make an argument the movie is literally looking for constant similarities, right?
Like absolutely.
Obsessions with similarities.
I think
and
that's
at the
one
end of
the
movie, there's actually a difference, like a stark difference between both of them that they cannot run away from.
Mm.
And while he tries to blind himself.
Maybe he's like, he comes to the realization, I don't need to.
I don't need to because I still love her.
Oh, I like that.
Right?
I like that a lot. Yeah. Dude, that's fucking good.
Yeah, because I can, I can support her in ways that she can't support herself.
Mm.
And she can support me in ways that I still can't support myself. Like, there's still a need for her, even
Absolutely.
If she is blind. I don't know. Like, that to me, it's more wholesome. If you think about it, it's more wholesome if that's the interpretation you get out of the movie.
Yeah.
At least from my perspective, like, that makes more sense why he didn't... He didn't gouge his eyes, right?
Gotcha.
Or he didn't maybe like cut his eyes, whatever
sure.
it is he does.
That maybe him rushing to the bathroom to try to do it was like the last effort to conform to the society where it's all about the surface similarities.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe he comes to a realization that we can have a type of love that's not governed.
Yeah, so it's a kind of...
By that expectation?
To me, it's like a... sounds kind of cliche, but it's like a third way. Like it's a kind of rebelliousness outside of the radicals of the loners, and then also outside of the status quo of the couple society.
Gotcha.
Right, and it's their own kind of like, hey, like no one's explored this, but this exists as a possibility, or could exist as a possibility.
Sure,
right.
Sure.
We can, you know, if the movie's an explanation on dystopia. This explanation that we're giving about the end of the movie could be a utopic vision.
Okay, okay. Maybe say just a little bit more about that.
Yeah, in the sense that it gives an alternative way from the two ways that the black and white ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, because it's a constant duality of like it's either this or that.
Right.
It's either couples or loneliness.
It's either love with these like... silly similarities,
right?
Or
superficial similarities, right?
Or kind of an aloneness where it's kind of existing with others, but there's no real bond
for connection. Yes.
And then what's the third way?
The third way,
the utopic way that you're describing.
The third way is to still capture connection by embracing differences.
Yeah, yeah, and still maintaining individuality.
Individuality, yeah. Individuality, but also experiencing love with a couple, right? Experiencing love with someone, but outside of the superficial.
Yeah.
Categories that they impose sure. on people, right? Like if we were just, you know, an IKEA furniture, right?
Yeah,
like that's it. And that to me, that would be the utopic vision that exists within the movie.
I like it.
That maybe isn't maybe not, you know, it's not in your face explicit, but it's implicitly there.
No, no, no,
and
I'm glad that it wasn't because it leads to these kinds of nuanced conversations.
Yes, yes. No, I love it. That's
Dude, this is great.
That's a good, yeah, I actually didn't think about that until we were having the conversation.
I didn't either. Ah, the value of actually having conversations.
Yes.
You learn something. Okay, so Rudy, this has been incredible.
Yeah.
Before we kind of end, anything else you feel like we've missed about the movie? I think we've covered kind of most things. I mean, there's so much there. I definitely would say watch it. It's on Max right
it's on
now.
Max, yeah.
It's an A24 production, which is incredible.
Yeah. Like look out for the little symbolisms. There's a lot of that going on. All kinds of weird animals that used to be people all over the forest. You see all kinds of like camels and flamingos and what are the other kind of birds that we saw that the peacock,
yeah.
And to me, they're intentionally there to represent something which we didn't really like hack into.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about it because I don't know. To me, it's a bit of an enigma, but I think you're probably right.
Yeah, I mean the ambiguities exist there, and they're also in the background. Man, and that's what I love about A24 films because they do all that on purpose.
Sure,
it's a lot of intentionality in the things that they do. And something we missed at the beginning of the film, which we actually talked about before the podcast, but the lady at the beginning of the film who shoots the donkey.
Fucking lady just like, she's driving in the rain, gets out of her car, pulls up to a fucking donkey, like I think with a revolver and shoots it a couple times. And you're like, what in the hell? And then you realize it was probably an ex-husband or somebody she hated.
Someone that was a part of their life that they hated. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. The comedy and the absurdity of the movie is there.
It's incredible.
There as well. Yeah, it's a great film.
Awesome. Okay, man. Dude, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you.